Welcome to episode 45 of Fresh Out Tokens podcast. This is Tanya, also known as Cypher Tier, and to my virtual right is David.
Hello.
Hello. And we are very, very lucky to have this week as our guest Eve Eschenbacher, also known as Midnight Rem on the Twitters.
Hello.
Yay. And so for those of you listening, we have teas and other items in the I Need Diverse Games Spreadshirt shop, and we split the profits 50-50 with our friend Chachi Bobinks, who designed our logo and header. There's also a blog to compliment the show at outoftokenscast.com. You have questions, compliments, want to be a guest, have questions about a guest, or suggest one, you can email us at freshoutoftokens@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at outoftokenscast, or on Tumblr, also at outoftokenscast.tumblr.com. Basically, we are everywhere. We are also on Facebook. Musical accompaniment for Fresh Out of Tokens is provided by Mike Moody. You can hear more of her work at soundcloud.com/MikeMoody-1. And with our usual intro spiel out of the way, let's get into questions with Eve. So thank you for joining us today.
Yep, no problem.
So for those folks who may not know who you are or what you do, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Let's see. I am currently a VO producer over at ArenaNet. I manage all of the recording sessions for Guild Wars 2. I get the scripts together. I arranged with a third-party vendor to get our actors booked, get studio time, and then I'm actually sitting in the studio with the actors and with a representative from the narrative team getting the lines that go into the video game that I work on.
Awesome. I'm going to tell myself that I had no clue you were a YA author.
Yes, I have a lot of stuff going on. Like, I just introduced what I do immediately, but I have actually done a lot of stuff. I've been in the games industry for 11 years. I got my start in video game localization, Japanese to English. I do YA novel writing, and in addition to my 9-to-5 job as the VO producer at ArenaNet, I also do freelance translation for a number of clients, including Prima Games. So I help them with translating strategy guides for the U.S. market.
Oh, that's awesome.
You just talked about how you do voiceover production. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. In games, everything that you hear in games has to be recorded. And there's a lot of production that goes into getting that recorded. You know, you not only have the designers making the scenes where the audio goes, but you have the writers writing the lines, and then you need to get that to the actors to record in the studio. And so I am the one helping the writers prep those lines. I'm running table reads where we sit in a room and we read all the content out loud and think, you know, does this sound on voice for the character? Is it really hard to say, or is it easy to say? You know, if it's hard to say, then we try and like rewrite it, because if we're stumbling trying to read it out loud, then the actor's probably going to stumble as well. We want to make sure that it makes sense and it's accurate to what's going on in the game itself. And I'm booking the time with the actor, or getting time arranged. Sorry. Let me try that again. I'm working with our third-party vendor to get the actors in the studio time booked. I prepare the scripts and provide them to our vendor. And in preparing the scripts, there are rules with the Screen Actors Guild, SAG, about what an actor can perform in a session. They're only allowed to do 3 voice roles, and they're only allowed to record for up to 4 hours in one go. Anything past that, you know, is outside of the rules, and you'd have to pay for another session, or, you know, pay for an extra fee. So we're trying to keep things all above board and according to SAG rules. So I'm, you know, making sure that we haven't tried to assign too many lines or tried to assign too many voice roles. And then I actually travel to the studio. We usually record in Burbank, California. So I travel to the studio and sit in the studio with the director and the actors and somebody from our narrative team to get the lines that we need. And then on the back end, I keep track of any changes that we make in the studio and put them in our system so that the text appears properly and the subtitles appear accurate to the text. And then, you know, more stuff happens and it ends up in the game and you get to hear it and see it as it is.
Oh, that's really cool. Well, you mentioned that you do many things. Aside from voiceover management and kind of getting folks to where they need to be and scheduling all of that, you also do localization work. And while they're not really different, they're different aspects of the game industry. And I was wondering kind of how you wind up doing localization as well as voiceover management.
Let's see. I kind of started actually at localization and worked my way over to voiceover. My entertaining story, if you ask anybody in the games industry how they got in the games industry, you'll always get the, well, I didn't get into the games industry the normal way story. And to the point where I'm not sure that there is a normal way. But my entertaining story of how I got into the games industry is that I went to Japan after I graduated college. I have a scientific and technical communications degree with a minor in Japanese. And I went over to Japan to specifically work in Japan in the games industry. I found work at a translation company in Tokyo. And my first week there, they were getting things arranged for a recording session that was supposed to happen in California my second week there. But they were prepping one of my coworkers to go to that recording session. And he suddenly quit.
Oh, dear.
He was just like, you know what? I'm done. And just quit. And they were like, Eve, you speak English. You're going to California next week. And I was like, okay. I'm going to California next week. So we had to, like, I had to get my travel visa set up and all of that, like, in the matter of a few short days. But I got sent to California for this recording session that was for one of the Ark the Lad games, where I was the interpreter for the publisher and the actors with the Japanese client in the room as well. And my boss was there. And so I was, you know, running back and forth, interpreting for everybody in the room, you know, just kind of on almost no training, but, you know, let's take the challenge. I can do this. And that was my first foray into VO and my introduction to the games industry in general. After that, I was project managing on a number of projects in Japan in localization. So, you know, all kinds of recording sessions here and there for other games, but also, you know, working on translation projects and that kind of thing for different games. Maybe I should keep going about further localization, but that's how I got into it. I don't know.
Last week, we actually talked to Mel Fleming, who is in localization.
Mm-hmm.
So seems to be just a block of time we've devoted to that.
Well, it's a fascinating topic because I think a lot of folks don't realize what it means.
Yeah, there is a lot in there. But you're also a YA author.
Yes.
And your first book, Midnight, is out. What really, what started you with the writing? I was also going to say, why particularly in YA, which is the biggest field of novels, it seems?
Yes, YA kind of blew up in the last couple of years. See, I've always been writing, and getting into games localization was my way of merging my interest with interest in writing with my interest in Japanese language and video games. So it's kind of like an amalgamation of all of my interests. But I've been writing for years, short stories and the like, and so I decided, you know, I'm gonna sit down and write a novel, and I did, and I took a few years. I think I ended up writing it in 3 months, and then took a few years polishing it after that, because you don't ever really finish writing it. You just hit a point where you're like, okay, it's as good as I can get, even though I want to still fix it. I ended up publishing that through Book Trope last year, and it's out. You can buy it. It's Midnight. Midnight is the title. What got me into YA in general was that it was just a genre that I was interested in. One of the things that I like about YA is that it's kind of a universal experience. You know, because when you read adult fiction, you know, you may have, you know, here's this guy over here who's going through a divorce, or here's this girl over here who's, you know, stuck in a dead-end job. And it's so varied because the adult experience is in our culture is so varied. But everybody's a teenager. Almost everybody goes through junior high and high school, you know, with some exceptions for like homeschooling and things. But everybody has to go through those teen years. And it becomes like this universal experience where everybody can look at that and see something familiar. If they weren't that person, then they knew that person. And so that was what kind of drew me to writing a YA novel versus writing an adult novel.
Cool. So do you mind sharing like kind of a synopsis of Midnight?
Sure. Midnight is the main character, Karen, meets a guy at a party. And it turns out that he is a vampire. He's immortal. And he has a serum he writes on her arm that works with her DNA. She happens to be part of a line of people that he knows through the years. And it allows her to time travel through his timeline. So she, as she goes to bed at night, she wakes up in his past, in 18th century France. And so she's like doing this mystery. He recruits her by, you know, writing on her arm and giving her this power to time travel, recruits her into helping him figure out this mystery somebody stole something and they're trying to figure out who it was and how they did it and what they did. And during the course of her trying to help him solve this mystery, actually, I don't know if I should give away the big twist, but she ends up getting caught in time herself.
Well, I mean, you could kind of see that coming, though, as a catch, depending on how you're thinking about it. Like, this is too easy.
Yeah. It's too easy that she's just running around, but, like, the second act climax is that she gets thrown out of a window, and in order to save her life they have to turn her into a vampire, which removes the time travel serum, so she has to live through her life rather than just be able to close her eyes and go home.
Oh wow, which means a missing person in the present, her present rather. Huh, interesting.
So when she finally lives her way up to the day that she ended up leaving her present, you know, she's not really the person who left anymore.
Well, I'm sure, because like at that point they're like, okay, well, who are you? Where did you come from?
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. Huh. I'll have to get a copy because I've got a lot of flights in the next month. So,
just out of a personal curiosity, did you use an agent? Do you have an agent?
I do not have an agent. I published through a small press that's based out of Seattle called Book Trope.
All right. I wasn't familiar with that press. Seeing more and more of that, and I find it interesting, so I just wanted to add that to my list of things I know.
Yes. I'm also working on another book, but it's in its earlier planning stages right now.
Yeah. I don't know if this shift is good or bad. I know a few agents who hate me, so it might be better if there are fewer.
Okay, then. Don't hate on our producer. He's nice.
Well, I just met him, but he seems nice.
I know, right?
Yeah.
But speaking of industry, Eve, I had the pleasure of meeting you at GDC this year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had a chance to chat a bit, and we talked about, you know, the challenges you face, because, like you said, you've been in the industry for quite a while as a parent, also, you know, being open and honest about mental health issues. And I was wondering if you've had further thoughts or just things that you kind of wanted to bring out as points of discussion, because they're both very broad-ranging topics, and it's kind of hard to boil them down to just a couple questions on a podcast.
They are, yeah. My background is, I jokingly refer to myself as a unicorn, and, you know, it maybe that gives me a little sense of thinking I'm particularly special, but I think that there aren't as many people with the same the same life situations that I have in the industry. The reason I say it is because I've been in the industry 11 years, and I am a single parent to a 9-year-old boy. So there's not a lot of single mothers in the industry in the first place. You know, there are few women and even fewer single mothers. But my I just posted this on Twitter because April 2nd was World Autism Awareness Day, but my son and I are both autistic, and so there's that challenge as well, just being wired differently than everybody else. And I'm trying to, help him work his way through the world at the same time that I'm trying to figure everything out for myself as well. So it's a lot of fun. But maybe not fun. Fun might be the wrong word for it. It's interesting, shall we say.
Interesting is a word. Well, because I was just thinking about, there's so many different ways in which, devs exist. Because I don't know if you've ever seen, there was a newsletter for a while, talking about depression as a dev in the industry. It didn't come out very often because the person who wrote it, was suffering from depression. So I don't know if he was able to keep up the blog as he planned to. But that was the first time I'd really seen anyone kind of discuss it. And really acknowledge that, this is an issue that can affect you, across the board. But I don't know if it's more of an impact in the industry, the games industry, because, there's been these conversations about crunch going on. And, if you're already having depression or other mental health issues, and then having to work a 12, 14-hour day to get a game out the door, that can't help.
Yeah, it's definitely a very difficult sort of situation. There is a games industry initiative called Take This, I believe, that was set up by Russ Pitts. That's Russ Pitts used to be the editor-in-chief over at The Escapist for a while, and then I think he was at Polygon. I'm not sure what he's doing at the moment, so I do know that he's on Twitter, and they're still doing Take This. But there, he was open about his depression, and he set up the Take This organization. They do an AFK room at PAX, and I know where they, try and offer a quiet space for people to just kind of mentally recharge. And they've been talking about devs and depression. I think he also did some depression proof your studio talks at GDC a few times. But rather than kind of sound like an evangelist for him, that's just the one thing that I'm aware of. I know that mental health in general is something that's just not talked about in society, because you don't ever want to show a weakness, and it's considered to be a weakness, even from the people that that have it. You don't want to. It's harder to admit it because you don't want to show weakness. You don't want to put blood in the water for the sharks, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you don't want to talk about it. You want to hide any type of quote unquote problem that you may have so that, people don't know that on the inside you're screaming or whatever, which I've been there. And I think that, the long hours and crunch don't help. You get burnout from devs. You get, people just feeling down, and that it seems that more people have been willing to talk about it a little bit in the more recent times. I've seen people talking about depression on Twitter and it's becoming a little bit more acceptable, but there's not people just outright saying, oh, by the way, or tossing it in their bio or anything. For me, when I came out about being autistic, I had a whole lot of stress about doing it in the first place, and I ended up working my way up to it. I said, okay, on World Autism Awareness Day, it's April 2nd, I'm going to do it then. But I had been thinking about it for months, and I received my diagnosis 2-3 years ago now. So it's been a while where I've just been no, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to hide it. Nobody knows. And then finally I was you know what? This isn't helping my situation, and it's not helping my son, because I'm trying to teach my son to be proud of who he is. And if I'm saying, be proud, but hide it, then that's not really helping for him. So I finally decided, I think I can do this.
Well, That's cool. Have you, and if you don't want to answer this, if it's too personal, feel free. But have you had any kind of like pushback or the usual, oh my God, I didn't know this, and then people treat you differently or reaction to being open about your autism?
Fortunately, I haven't had any pushback that I've seen. Mm-hmm. I haven't had any obvious points where people have treated me differently. I did have a few of the reactions where, I didn't know, or I would never have guessed. And it's funny because it's an invisible condition. You don't suddenly have purple hair because you're autistic or something like that.
Right.
There's no obvious thing around it that people can look at you and know. So for the most part, the reaction was really positive. If anybody had anything negative to say, they didn't say it and in any field that I could see. And my friends in the industry were all quite positive, very supportive. Hey, this is great. And, good on you for sharing this. One of my coworkers ended up, buying me a small gift of a bottle of Irish coffee because I had jokingly lamented my lack of Irish coffee as a segue into speaking about it, the whole quote unquote liquid courage.
Yeah.
I felt like I wanted to start off with a little bit of humor, and that was my easiest way to do it. And she was like, you've done something brave and that should be rewarded. So she, gave me this tiny little gift. I thought it was very sweet of her. And everybody else has been just really positive, oddly enough. So it was really a giant relief to just see positive reactions to it rather than negative.
That's really cool. I'm glad to hear that.
How have you dealt with the challenges of Japanese to English localization and translation?
Let's see. I've done localization at a translation company level, and then I've done it for Pokemon, where they have a very different standard. And then I've done projects where I'm just the freelance translator working for another translation company, contracted out. So I've been on a few different angles of this particular problem. Well, each time it's basically been, what does the higher up want? What does either the company that I'm translating for, or my company that I'm working for, want out of this particular translation? So if I'm doing a freelance project, I'm asking them, like, what kind of ESRB rating are you looking for? What kind of audience is this game for? Or I'm looking at the game itself and just assessing where this is at, and just making sure that I'm hitting the notes that they want. I'm asking about ESRB rating with some of the more adult games, because you want to know, okay, do you want me to swear? Are you looking for a T rating, or are you looking for a mature rating? Because what you have in the Japanese source isn't always what ends up in the English. I had a game that I was working on for Pokemon where one of the lines I had to translate, one of the characters called another character Kusoyaro, which translates to shithead.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't think that Pokemon allows that, so what can I do here? And I had a conversation with my coworker, and they said, no, we don't allow people to call people names in these games like that. So I tried to soften it to like jerk or something like that, and they said, no, just write around it. This person's not going to call anybody a name. I'm like, okay, so that's the request from the client. That is where I'm writing to. sometimes you end up with like the funny little bits of story where you're like, here's a completely obscure Japanese pun. How am I going to make this make any blasted sense in English? Because it just does not work when you try and translate it. And so you try and come up with something similar, or you try and write around it. Sometimes you end up, when you're translating for handhelds, I've translated for mobile devices and Nintendo DS a few times, and sometimes you end up with like these tiny character limits where they're like, okay, here's you're allowed 35 characters in a line and two lines on a page. And, you know, your Japanese source got it all in one page, and we can't allow you to add more pages because we have memory limits. So even though that was a paragraph in Japanese, you're going to have to edit it down for the English because it just won't fit. And sometimes you just you have to figure out what's the most important thing in the source to put in the English when you're translating there. It's not always a one-to-one translation just because you have limits around either the language or the tech.
Yeah. Japanese to English and English to Japanese is always... It's a fun dance to do because there are things that I still mess up. Like, if I remember the word, like what it should be, I'm just like, yeah, no, I'm just not even going to try because I'm sure I'll mess it up.
I don't know any Japanese, but I have played like multiple fan translations of Final Fantasy games, and it's amazing how far they can vary.
Yes.
I didn't realize there were fan translations of Final Fantasy games.
Yeah, they're all over the internet. They're out there.
All over the internets?
I'm pretty sure they're not legal.
Probably not. But speaking of pushback or altering games... Seen or have you ever gotten pushback on a game you've worked on, you know, for instance, not making appropriate cultural changes because people may think a game has changed too much from porting it from country of origin to a Western audience?
See, I fortunately have not seen a lot of pushback.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen some. I worked on a game doing freelance where we had, we absolutely had to change the age of one of the characters. That was one of the moments. Yeah, it was one of those like, what in the world am I? I am only the translator. I cannot fix this. I am only the translator. I cannot fix this.
Right.
I had another game that I worked on where I had to say that same thing. That's the mantra you have to tell yourself sometimes because you are just the person hired to do the job. One game I worked on was about these firefighters, and this junior firefighter was running around and he's like, I'm going to take the elevator up to the 60th floor where the fire is. And I'm like, I'm thinking, you're not supposed to take elevators in the fire. The art and the cinematic in the game is him running into the elevator, so there's not really much I can do about this. And sure enough, two scenes later, he's stuck in the elevator, and the elevator's about to come crashing down to the ground, and I'm just like, I'm only the translator. I cannot fix this. I'm only the translator. I cannot fix this. Just have to go with it.
Wow. I'm just like, who... Like, I don't care what... Like, who decides to take an elevator in a fire? Especially a firefighter.
On the other hand, you know, the fire was up on, like, the 60th floor or something. So is he supposed to run 60 flights of stairs up with fire gear on? I'm not entirely sure.
Mm.
But he was just one of those, like, please tell me this dumbass isn't going to take the elevator. Oh, he's taking the elevator. And he's stuck in the elevator. And you gotta save him because he's stuck in the elevator. Of course. Okay.
Yeah, that was something.
Ooh, yeah. People write weird stuff. It's all the time.
Yes.
Speaking of writing and things, what's next on your plate? What's coming up for you?
What's coming up for me? See, I've got my day job where I'm still the VO producer at ArenaNet, so I'm still working on our upcoming releases and everything that they've got planned. And then on a personal note, still doing freelance work to keep my Japanese language skills up. I just finished a project there. And I am in my free time, big air quotes around free time, I am working on my next novel. So outlining that and starting to write scenes and characters and everything right there. So been almost a year since the last one came out. Holy cow, has it been that long already? But I'm working on the second one, I swear, really.
Cool. Well, once it's done, you have to tell us all about it so we can, so we can like go promote you. Because, you know, I think it's really awesome that you write and make games and do all this other stuff. Because Like, I sort of kind of can do one thing well, and that's really it.
My life has kind of revolved around creative, basically, writing and voicing things, you know, making things. And so, you know, I write localization, but I also write fiction in, you know, my native language, English. But it's always kind of around this sort of orbiting around the idea of narrative in general.
Awesome. Well, our next section is, you know, if we're lucky enough to get questions from our listeners, that's where we kind of, you know, put those out to you, our guest. And then we wrap up with talking about what we've been playing / reading lately. And our usual suspect, Tim, has come through, as always, with a few questions for you. I feel like we should just make him part of the show at some point because he always has good questions. But Thane, 1982, asks, do you feel like your localization work has helped or informed your writing?
That's a good question. I would say that it has a little bit in that I'm thinking about audience, you know, thinking about, or when I wrote my young adult novel, I was thinking about the audience that I was writing for. And, you know, when I'm localizing, I'm thinking about the audience I'm writing for, but not too much directly other than that, you know, I haven't really tried writing in other languages or anything like that. So there's not a thought of like, oh, somebody's going to be translating this down the line or anything like that. So I'm not sure that it's directly informed my writing. Helping, maybe. I try and stay concise rather than rambly, but everybody gets rambly. So...
Definitely. I totally can, if people don't catch me, especially on certain topics.
Always claim it's a stylistic choice when you're paid by the word.
Yes.
Do you want me to get the next question?
Sure.
All right. Tim also asks, what has been your greatest challenge in localizing for an English-speaking audience?
I would say that on the minor challenge side, the character limits have always been a challenge when the source that I'm translating for has a limited memory, has a limited, you know, number of pages, has a limited character count. You have to be very careful about how you word things, and you have to decide what's most important. And so that, you know, you can't just get rambly or say things the way you want to say them every time, because you end up running into those hard limits of, no, you're not allowed to go over this character count, or no, you're not allowed to go over this page count, or no, you're not allowed to go over this memory allocation. So you have to decide what's most important and cut the rest. And that's always challenging, trying to write to those limits and going, oh man, I had the perfect way to phrase this, but it's two characters over. Damn it. Can I misspell this maybe? Like, it's almost like writing for Twitter, trying to write a novel on Twitter or something.
Oh, no.
You hit those moments where you're just like, what grammatical sin can I commit in order to make this fit that the editors are going to go through and fix and be angry at me for anyway?
It's like, I tried. Sorry. Yeah. Speaking of wishing bad things, or not wishing bad things, but Tim's last question was, have you ever played a Japanese developed game and wish you'd been on the localization team?
I have played a number of games. I think Final Fantasy, where the Final Fantasy series was that series where I played through it and I was like, this is what I want to do. Before I started working in localization, I was like, this is it. This is the thing for me. I found my calling. And then once I actually got into the industry and I've been working, I haven't had one that's called out to me since, you know, where like, after I've already been in localization, where I've been like, oh man, I wish I could have worked on that. But I have had some where I've just been like, that was amazing. And I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall trying to figure that bit out. The Professor Layton series, they're this Japanese series that had a lot of puzzles in them. And I was just looking at it going, a lot of these puzzles had to have been, you know, based around the Japanese language and puns and characters and kanji characters and things like that that just would not work when you pull them outside of Japan. So clearly they've done some translations for some, and other places they must have just had to replace puzzles wholesale and just say, like, this isn't going to work in another language. So I would love to have seen behind the scenes for some of those discussions and some of those moments where they had to just be like, you know what, this puzzle's got to go.
Interesting. Oh, echo. That was weird.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what post-production's for.
Yeah.
It seems to be gone.
Yeah, that's really weird. It's like I literally leaned back like a couple inches and suddenly echo.
That doesn't make any sense to the laws of physics as I know them.
No, but, you know.
It can't have just been that.
I moved forward and the echo stopped. That's all I got.
She leaned back and moved like half a second back in time.
Yes, temporal magic. That explains all of it.
Yes.
There you go. We committed sins of temporal magic. That is now the episode title. Have nothing to do with anything else we talked about. I just like it.
It kind of ties into the theme on my book.
Hey, that works.
Yeah.
All right. We have our episode title, folks. And by the time you get to this, you've already seen the episode title, so ha. But we always end the show kind of, you know, wrapping up what we've all been playing, or in the case of some guests who aren't so much into playing games, maybe more making them, we talk about what we've been reading. So since you are our esteemed guest, you get to go first.
Let's see. I have been playing Fallout 4 because I play a lot of Fallout, in the Fallout series in general. Tying back into what I mentioned before about being autistic, Fallout is one of my special interests. So I just love the series, and that's a game that I have been playing a lot of. I just finished Destiny the Taken King, so I'm not playing that anymore, but I was playing it. And I've been playing Lego Dimensions with my son, and Animal Crossing New Leaf also with my son, but, you know, still having fun with those games.
Huh. I have never played Animal Crossing. Is New Leaf a game you can kind of just hop into if you've never played them?
Yes. It's a very, very laid-back sort of game. You don't need to know the series or any of the history. Although if you do, then you know a little bit more about the characters, but you're just kind of tossed into a town where you suddenly become the mayor, and you need to, you know, build up a little house and run around picking fruit and collecting bugs. And it's a quiet little game, but you can go over to other people's towns. And so my son and I will play together where he has a copy, I have a copy, and we'll travel to each other's towns and help each other pick fruit and things.
Oh, that's really awesome.
Yeah.
David, what have you been playing?
I have been playing Deus Ex Invisible War because I must have bought it on a Steam sale when it was 99 cents or something. And it was a game that was actually very, very critically, people hated it, but I didn't, and playing it again, it still holds up, actually. It's not that bad. It's just not the same tone as the first one. I've been playing Fallout 4, and I have a season pass, and the new DLC came out, but I haven't seen any of the content from that DLC because it's all about building stuff, and I'm also in, like, the survival mode beta, so right now my character lives in a hotel and kills people for money.
Okay.
She doesn't own anything.
But if she kills people for money, does she really need assets that'll drag her down? Fair question.
It is.
You need to make enough money to pay the hotel people. That's why she doesn't own anything. Because living is expensive in survival mode.
I was just thinking more like if she has to like pick up and run. No attachments.
And I've also been playing Mortal Kombat 10X, depending on how you feel about Roman numerals. But it's the Android version, because it was free. And, yeah, there's no, like, you can't actually, like, fight people or anything. You just fight an AI with teams that other people picked.
That's not really Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, but I think it's as close as you can get with a phone.
Probably. I'm glad neither of you can see the weird face I just made. Kind of like I made that RCA dog head tilt because I can't quite figure out where that was going.
My phone recommended it to me and told me it was free, so I installed it. This is probably why the government knows everything about me.
Wow. As for me, I've actually been playing a couple indie things. I played Orion Legend of the Koryodon, which is from Kiru Studios, the first studio in Cameroon. And I wrote up a post about it, actually, because I was super excited to play it, and I did a special stream of it. And I didn't want to nitpick too much on the grammar or editing, but I almost wanted to, like, do reverse localization on it. Because it was made in Cameroon, it was, like, there's some weird idiomatic things that don't, like, for me as a native English speaker, I'm just kind of like, that doesn't quite fit together right. But my main concern, I won't even call it a complaint, it's a concern because it's early in the game for me, where I'm going through the story, is that you're playing Enzo, who is about to become king and get married, and there's a coup. And, you know, you manage to get married, and your wife is there, but she's literally an AoE healer. She doesn't really seem to have a part outside of that. And, you know, like, you both kind of get battle armor before you continue on the narrative of the story. And he makes remarks about, like, how skin tight it is and going out in public like that. And it's like, well, she's not property. So I'm not sure yet how I feel about the game. Control-wise, it's amazing. Controls are tight. I would highly recommend a controller because it is on PC. And there's some fighting game elements. But overall, it's a good first effort. I'm hoping that the characterization improves as the game goes on. So, so for those of you listening, I will include a link to that blog post. And if you can get the game, either watch the video, watch some playthrough, see what other people are thinking about it. I know other people on Twitter brought up that concern as well, and actually some of the devs at Kiru did respond. But it could also be a cultural issue of what they see as strong is not what I, as an American black woman, would see as a strong character. So we shall see. And I also played 80 Days, which was fun. I don't know what I'm doing. I wasted a lot of money trying to bribe my way to faster travel. I'm so bad at it. Like, I made it 39 days. I was nowhere near, like, halfway around the world, and I was down to, like, under 1,000 pounds sterling.
Yes.
So I am a failure travel in that game so far.
I've had the same issue with that, where it's just like, I don't know what I'm doing. And yeah, it's funny.
I finally figured out, and someone pointed out in the stream that I was letting the clock go too far, so I would miss boats and trains and airships. And I was like, oh, and then I was buying tickets like twice without realizing it. I was like, oh, that explains why I spent like a week in Athens. Oh, so. Oh, I just felt silly because I'm like, okay, how do I like go from where I'm at now to the next place? And so I finally figured out that when you click on a destination, it'll tell you like, oh, the airship or the train or whatever. It leaves in 2 days. It leaves like in 5 hours. And if it's the same day, you can just say I'm departing and the clock advances. But I like totally missed a train and spent a week in Athens, not on purpose.
Oops.
Yeah. So it's fun. I really enjoy it. We were lucky enough to get Meg Giant in the chat, and she's going to be a future guest on the show. So,
awesome.
Yeah, Meg is amazing. Like, she talked a lot about NPCs and agency, and, you know, talked about 80 Days and how the character you're playing doesn't always get what he wants, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm really excited. Meg will be on the show in a couple weeks.
I will definitely have to listen to that one.
Yes. I'm excited. I'm trying to think if I played anything else. I've been playing Inquisition, as always. It's kind of my comfort game now. So if I've had a hard day, I just go back and play Inquisition. And maybe I will finally get to stream some Fallout on PC because I had to reinstall the game. And I still need to mod it, so.
I couldn't get it to stream.
No?
No, I think it was too much for my computer to do both.
Well, I've got it on console, but I can't mod the console version.
That is always the challenge.
Well, supposedly console mods are supposed to be a thing with Fallout 4. I just don't know when that will actually happen.
Right. It's coming.
Probably about a month after we all expect it to.
Yeah. Well, there's also the PS4, like, whatever the 4.5 is supposed to be coming out. Have either of you heard that tidbit about a new PlayStation?
I am sure that the console mods will probably come to PlayStation last because it's so different from a computer.
Oh yeah, I honestly don't expect mods to come to.
Yeah, they have become very PC centric, which I support, but yeah, it has bad parts.
So sadly, our conversation is at an end. At least for this episode. We don't have to stop talking until after we hit the stop button. But Eve, thank you so much for chatting with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
You are very welcome. You can always come in and chat with us. So for those folks listening and who may want to follow you on all the social media type things, where can folks find you?
Let's see, on Twitter, I am Midnight Rem, R-E-M, all one word. See, my website is eveewriter.com because my last name is ridiculous and difficult to spell. And I'm also on Facebook. There's a link to my Twitter and my Facebook from eveewriter.com, so you can probably find me there, but I don't spend as much time on Facebook as I probably should.
It's the devil. Don't do it.
Yes. I don't know. The thing about Twitter I like is that it's short little bites. The thing I don't so much like about Facebook is, just, for one, you know, my extended family found me on Facebook where they didn't find me on Twitter. Mm. So there's that. And then on the other hand, like Facebook, you don't see things because they hide it from you. So, you know, the algorithms or whatever, they want to just show you the important stuff. So you don't find out that, like, oh, my friend had a baby, or, oh, somebody's getting married. You find out about it, like, weeks afterwards because Facebook never showed it to you.
Yeah, that show you top stories algorithm, I don't know who designed it, but they need to redo that entire thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I finally got that stupid memories thing to stop.
Yes. I almost never get memories because I almost never post anything on Facebook.
Yeah, but without, like, I was waiting for it to give me, like, some bad memory, and it finally happened, and I'm like, okay, we're done. We're done here. And with that cheerful note, David, where can people find you online?
Not Facebook, actually. I can be found on Twitter at Red Conversation. I have a website that is davidlreeves.com. I have a Patreon that is patreon.com/redconversation. And if you need an editor or someone who is very good at the English language to help you with anything, you can send me an email at work@davidlreeves.com.
Cool.
Yeah, and I think that's actually all of the things.
I'm Cyphertier everywhere. Basically, if you look up Cyphertoftyr, it's probably me. And we are actually taking a break next week because of PAX East. So this episode, when you are hearing it, it will be 7 days from now on April 27th. And next time we record, it will be with our friend Zufit, formerly of Justice Points, and now with Pop Culture Coven. So see you in a week. Bye.